Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We have a Memorial Day themed show in store for you today. With the Memorial Day holiday just around the corner in the second half of our show today, it's time to hit the road. We check in with travel writer Alicia Underlie-Nelson about some Memorial Day travel tips. Rick Yone joins us in his weekly edition of Prairie Plates. He's also talking about holiday food as we start the summer season. But first, we lead off today's show with an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show. Host John Harris sits down with a remarkable guest, Bradley Onney. Bradley is a retired U.S. Marine Corps and U.S. Army veteran with an impressive service record that spans 22 years. He's also a past commander of Post 2 of the Fargo American Legion. In this conversation, Bradley shares his experiences from various deployments, his transition to civilian life, and his ongoing work with veterans. Bradley's stories and insights are both poignant and inspiring.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bradley, you're retired U.S. Marine Corps and retired U.S. Army. Spent 4 years in the Corps, you told me, and 18 years in the Army. Past commander of Post 2, Fargo American Legion. So please, tell us about yourself and maybe your background.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Mayville, North Dakota, joined the Marine Corps out of high school, went off to boot camp, and then served in the Marine Corps for 4 years doing security forces on the ship and infantry missions. While in the Marine Corps, I was deployed to the Persian Gulf, and we were part of Operation Earnest Will, and that was my first combat mission. And then came back home, went to college at Mayville State, got my degree there, and while there, I joined the Army National Guard. Spent 18 years with the Army National Guard with a deployment to Iraq in 2004 and 05. As a first sergeant for our unit, and returned from there. Now I work with veterans as an employment counselor.
Talk about some of those various deployments you had in some of those years of service. And of course, you're wearing a number of medals there.
In 87, we were deployed to Operation Earnest Will while in the Marine Corps, and that was escorting oil tankers in and out of the Straits of Hormuz. And so it was kind of a little known operation, but you know, at that time it was a pretty big deal to the USS Stark was attacked in the Persian Gulf back then, and we were supported that. We also, you know, went through all the different schools in the Marine Corps, the infantry school, the jungle environment survival training, the assault climbers course, mountaineering courses, desert training, all that kind of craziness. And then from there, went into the Army Guard, and then, you know, I took various courses and trainings, leadership courses. You know, it was Air Defense Unit by name, you know, and we did a lot of that stuff. But once we were deployed to Iraq, we basically became an infantry company, because most everybody becomes an infantry company in Iraq. We relieved an active duty Army infantry unit from their battle space, and then took over their mission. And then we got another mission on top of that to train 400 Iraqi soldiers, set up an entire battalion of Iraqi troops. So we had a very intense experience in Iraq. We had, you know, several of our vehicles, troops were hit with IED explosions. That was really big at that point in the war in 2004 and 05. So a lot of IED experiences, rocket attacks regular all the time, to the point where it just became routine. You'd be worried if you didn't get rocket shot at you on the base. You know, we had some troops that got injured. You know, fortunate that we got all 100 North Dakota soldiers back to North Dakota. At the end of the day, that's really all that matters. But, you know, we stood up an Iraqi Army battalion, which was typically, this is a lot of what special forces units do and that type of thing. But we did that. We had a fantastic leadership team and the best troops in the Army, as far as I'm concerned. A lot of veterans of other services that joined the Guard. So we had a great team of soldiers, and we took on that mission, which was a pretty big deal.
But were there some comrades who maybe didn't make it back that you might honor this Memorial Day?
Yes. Well, there was a gentleman that was from Oregon that was in a sister unit to us, and he was always kind of hanging around us guys. And his name is Mark Ogburn. We called him Augie. And Augie was killed in Iraq. So, you know, you think about him and units, other members of the North Dakota Guard that were in Afghanistan around the same period of time. that soldiers that I trained and worked with and used to be in my platoon that went to Afghanistan with the other North Dakota unit were killed over there in Afghanistan. So I always honor those, and also in Iraq. You know, there's another former Marine slash became an Army soldier with the Guard. He was killed in Iraq around the same time. So those are the folks that I honor on Memorial Day because, you know, they gave the ultimate sacrifice. You know, I just, you know, one thing that stands out in memorials is when you do a ramp ceremony, they call it, overseas, and they have the flag draped casket loaded onto an aircraft, and to see one of your fellow soldiers go out that way, it really, really brings home the meaning of sacrifice, and it's just such a powerful experience. You know, and then the next minute, load up in your trucks and go outside the wire and go to your mission. So, you know, a lot of times you don't get the chance to process everything that's going on.
With Memorial Day coming up, why is it so special as an observance?
I think it's super important because, you know, some of us volunteers, some of us were drafted, but, you know, Memorial Day is to honor those that died in service. And, you know, and to honor, you know, those that have gone before us. And, you know, in the military, they have that tradition of, you know, honoring your past, your history, and all that type of thing. And just taking the time to stop and reflect on why we're free and who gave that freedom to us and the ultimate sacrifices that they made for us. You know, and I also throw in, you know, into that, my friends that have completed suicide since they got back, because they're still fighting that war and they couldn't quite shake it, you know.
What are the functions of area VFWs and American Legions, and maybe the distinction between?
Sure. Well, the Legion is, you know, you had to serve in the military. So that's kind of their gateway to get in. You got the AMVETs. If you served in uniform, you can also join the AMVETs. The VFW, you have to have a campaign badge. So you had to serve in a theater of war, not necessarily in frontline war, but in a theater of combat, you get to join the VFW. They have the Disabled American Veterans, the DAV. You have to have some kind of service-connected disability to be eligible to join them. I'm also, you know, past commandant to the Marine Corps League, and the Marine Corps League is you have to have be a Marine veteran and or Navy corpsman that served with the Fleet Marines or Navy chaplain that served with the Fleet Marines. They have Navy leagues. They have, you know, several other. Well, I might be missing one here, but
for the most part, they're honoring veterans in some fashion.
Yes.
Talk about the things that you do with veterans in our region.
I'm a Veterans Employment Counselor for Job Service North Dakota. I've been doing that about 16 years now. And so as part of that, I get to work with veterans, specifically veterans that may have some barriers to employment. You know, they could be prior incarcerated, or they could be homeless, or they could be just, you know, switching careers or coming right out of the service or leaving college. So all those veterans I get the opportunity to work with and help them or guide them maybe to a different career, or maybe guide them to some training or education. So basically that's my role. You know, I go to the homeless shelters here in town. I go to the Cass County Jail and provide outreach there. You know, working with the folks at the VA and the county service officers, you know, that's what I have the opportunity to get to help veterans.
Yeah. Can you talk and tell the folks out there what PTSD is?
Was post-traumatic stress, you know, and not just, it's not just a military thing. And people, anybody can get PTSD from a traumatic event in their life. PTSD for me is from my service and some of the situations that I was put in while in service and things I had to do or and witness my troops having to do or be a part of. And, you know, it's causes, you know, all different types of things, but, you know, a lot of stress, anxiety, trust issues, those type of things. And 12 years ago, I went through PTSD treatment at the VA myself, and I'm still involved as a peer mentor, volunteer, and meeting with veterans, you know, over a coffee. And, you know, if they're, you know, and talking to them, they might get a referral from the VA saying this vet's thinking about treatment, but really doesn't want to do it. And so I'll meet with them and try to encourage them to just give it a chance.
Yeah. You know, what are the programs or services trying to deal with the mental health issues that, that veterans have?
Well, we have, you know, the VA's got, their mental health clinics, mental health providers up there. The Vet Center is also in town here. You know, there's some private, counseling services that can help a veteran with that. There's online resources, but, your best bet would be to talk to someone at the VA or at the Vet Center to get kind of started on your path if you believe or may have PTSD or a loved one that you know has it. Those folks can also reach out to that.
Can you talk a little bit about the suicide rate among veterans and why it's so high?
Well, they talk about 22 a day is kind of the number that's used, and it kind of fluctuates. One a day is too many. But it's just, sometimes folks come back from deployments or service and they don't deal with their PTSD or don't recognize that they even have it, and they maybe self-medicate with drugs or alcohol and anger issues and this and that go on and kind of destroys their relationships and leads them down a path where they feel that the only way out is to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm. And so what is your advice to a veteran if he or she has these mental health issues or suicide thoughts?
Yeah. I would encourage them to talk to anybody, another friend vet that they trust or anybody that they trust in their life, talk to them. But reach out to the VA, reach out to the Vet Center, reach out to your county veteran service officer. Those are all folks. I've had people come to my desk and start talking to them, at job service, and I'm like, maybe we should get you connected to someone up at the VA, So anybody that, just talk to somebody. Don't just hold all this in.
I assume, and maybe I shouldn't assume, the mental health issues are why many veterans end up homeless. But how do we allow our veterans to end up homeless? And what can we do about it?
Typically it's either some type of mental health issue, drugs, alcohol, something, their life spirals out of control, their relationships break up, they maybe get busted and become, get a criminal record. So it all kind of, it's a path, they don't come homeless overnight. Usually it's, they came out of the service, may have an honorable discharge, they had all these plans, and then somewhere along the line, they didn't address something they needed to address mentally or addiction-wise, and they end up homeless. There's plenty of opportunities and resources for a homeless veteran in this community, more so than a civilian. And, go down, they have the CRRC, center downtown here. Stop in there, stop in at the VA, and there will be people that will help you if you're a homeless vet. Just reach out to somebody.
Let me ask, you said, I think 12 years ago, you dealt with this.
Yeah.
How did you identify that you had to step up and deal with it?
I just knew that, it was causing a lot of anxiety, stress in my life, my relationship. And I knew there was something going on. And I got a degree in psychology, and I didn't quite figure it out myself. So, type of thing. So you don't always recognize it, but people around you, people I trust, they're like, maybe you should go talk to somebody. And I did, and that led me down the path where I have a lot more peace in my life because I can talk like this. I wouldn't ever be able to do that back then, talk about PTSD, suicide, this type of thing.
Is there anything maybe you want people to know that about the service or the armed forces that they don't know? Or?
Well, that, all these folks come from all over the country, all different shapes and sizes, walks of life. And they're all doing it for whatever reason. Some are, doing it for patriotism. Some are doing it because it's a family thing. Some are doing it because, maybe they want to get some school money. But at the end of the day, once you're in and you serve. And they do it, it's a camaraderie, a brotherhood, a sisterhood. We all need to be there together. And it's a great experience.
Finally, Bradley here. If people want more information, where would you tell them to go?
Anything veteran related, go to your county veteran service officer in whatever county you're in. Go talk to the county veteran service officer, ask them about your benefits. A lot of people have no idea what kind of benefits are available to them. go talk to them about benefits, any kind of experiences that way, veteran-wise. Go to the county service officer. That's a great gateway to get in.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
You know, freedom's not free.
That's right.
That was Prairie Pulse host John Harris with retired U.S. Marine Corps and U.S. Army veteran Bradley Ani. You can watch Prairie Pulse on our television service Thursdays at 8 p.m., and you can also find Prairie Pulse episodes on the Prairie Public YouTube channel. Up next, Tom Ezern continues his insight into the historical relevance of rest rooms and how rural North Dakotans fell behind in their development of restrooms for women. Here's his Plains Folk essay.
I've been talking lately about restrooms. No, not about the odd preoccupation we seem to have nowadays as to who might be using what facility, but rather about the reform movement in the early 1900s, which aimed to provide comfortable lounges for farm women who came to town with their husbands, transacted their business, and then were left in the lurch by husbands not yet ready to go home and had to sit waiting in a livery or some such place. Really, this was a popular cause across the country, as businessmen seeking farm trade and their spouses, organized into women's clubs, stirred themselves to make farm women comfortable in town. Indoor toilets, yes, but also clean sitting areas, cribs for babies and cots for mothers needing a lie down, reading materials, a table for eating lunch and visiting, restrooms. Except in North Dakota, where larger towns got the reform done, but country towns, who were the most dependent on farm trade, mostly lagged. Oh, their newspaper editors talked a great game, but citizens generally failed to get restrooms organized. And since in other states this was a great progressive accomplishment, I wonder why this was so. Here's a clue from the Pioneer Express of Pembina, 1910. The editor is responding to criticism in the Walhalla Mountaineer about the state of the county courthouse in Cavalier. The Mountaineer pointing to the fine $60,000 courthouse recently completed in Cooperstown, Griggs County. The response from the Pioneer Express is that the courthouse in Cavalier is fine, the one in Cooperstown is indulgent. Look at the specs, says the editor. They include a women's restroom, for whatever that may be. We can see such a room might be of value as a town convenience for country visitors, but hardly can see why the taxpayers of the county in general should supply such a room. What we see here is a lack of any sense of the public good, a founding principle of our country's framers, and the fundamental creed of progressivism in 1910. Was this sort of crass carping typical of North Dakota towns? I think not, but we can take a look at the well-documented restroom situation in Minot for a case study. There, in 1907, a woman signing herself Lady Farmer wrote the editor of the Independent and gave the businessmen of the Magic City an earful. She pleaded for Minot to provide a restroom where, she said, tired women and children could rest and relax a few moments before departing on their homeward journey. The editor backed her up with his personal observation on a cold, bitter day of a young mother and baby shivering outside in the doorway of a business house on North Main. A woman of very respectable appearances, yet a stranger here, who did not know where to go. And yet, businessmen and authorities dithered for years about the logistics of providing a restroom, such that every news story about the matter came to be headlined, sarcastically, "That Restroom." What more fundamentally is behind the failure of townspeople to provide restrooms for country women? The sources are silent. I have my suspicions. The towns were dominated by English-speaking Anglo-Americans who operated the businesses and ran the towns. The countryside of North Dakota, more than any other state of the Union at this point in history, was peopled by foreigners. European immigrants with their own languages and strange ways. The social distance between them and the townsfolk was just too great. This is my suspicion, one that correlates with other similar episodes at the time. This makes me uncomfortable. But history is not always a feel-good story. History is for learning.
That was Tom Ezern, distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and another of his wonderful Plains Folk essays. Up next, Rachel Kramer talks about plummeting wool prices in this report from Harvest Public Media.
It's early spring and sheep shearers have come to the Corey family farm. With smooth, clean strokes, a shearer cuts through several inches of wool on a ewe. In just minutes, a fleece drops to the floor and the ewe returns to the flock with her new buzz cut. On this day, more than 100 sheep at this central Iowa farm were sheared, each losing about 8 pounds of wool. But it won't bring in much money.
We'll get just a few cents a pound, really.
That's Mary Corey, regardless of what they get paid for the wool. She says shearing is essential for the sheep's health and for lambs to more easily nurse in the spring. Tom Corey, who started raising sheep in the early 1960s, remembers when wool was an asset.
I was able to get enough money from that wool that I could pay for their winter feed. Today, I can't even pay for half the shearing.
The Coreys, like most producers in the Midwest, raise sheep primarily for meat, not the wool. But as wool prices have dropped, the costs of shearing and transporting the wool are biting into producers' profits. Jalen Whaley is a sheep field specialist with South Dakota State University Extension.
We're in a really, I think, volatile place right now, we feel like, because our numbers are dropping and we're having a hard time keeping people in the industry.
She says the drop in wool prices is connected with global forces far from farms in Middle America. Demand from China, the largest importer of American wool, fell sharply in 2019 in the midst of a trade war with the U.S. Then COVID hit, shutting down wool processors and disrupting supply chains. But sheep kept growing wool, leading to a global oversupply and even lower prices. Whaley says there are options for sheep producers.
We just have to be willing to get innovative and make those changes that are profitable.
That includes finding new uses for wool. Wendy Johnson runs Counting Sheep Sleep Company from her northern Iowa farm. She shows off a creamy white and lightly speckled batting that comes from her sheep.
This is what fills the pillows. And it's just such a nice fiber.
Johnson sends her wool to a mill in Minnesota where it's cleaned and turned into this batting to fill pillows, comforters, eye masks that she then sells.
Here we raise this incredible animal on grass and sunshine and rain and soil alone. And they just keep growing this completely renewable fiber that has all these attributes.
Wool is thermoregulating, meaning it can keep people comfortable in hot and cold conditions. It's also biodegradable and can act as a natural fertilizer. In south central Nebraska, Megan Landis Murphy turns coarse wool from her sheep and other producers into pellets for the garden.
I think wool pellets are a great outlet for this underutilized wool, and then it's also beneficial for plant enthusiasts and gardeners alike.
The pellets add nitrogen to the soil and can absorb and release excess moisture. Landis Murphy says she's glad to help producers find a new use for their wool through her Kestrel Ridge Pellet Company.
I think it's really exciting for sheep producers because I've heard of them just like burying or burning their wool just to get rid of it because they feel like that's the only option they have.
But some producers are moving toward a sheep that doesn't produce much wool. Called hair sheep, they naturally shed in the spring, so no shearing is needed. Back on Tom and Mary Corey's farm, they've bought a small flock for one of their sons to raise.
To incorporate a hair breed of sheep that would not require the shearing, and there are also other potential benefits of just being a hardier type sheep.
But Ron Kilstrom, one of their shearers and a sheep producer himself, isn't so sure about wool-less sheep.
It disturbs me a little bit. Sheep should have wool on them, period.
After all, shearing sheep is his business. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including here at Prairie Public.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The U.S. House could soon be voting on its version of a new farm bill. The bill is close to 1,000 pages and has a cost of around $1.5 trillion. North Dakota Farmers Union President Mark Watney says it's a good start to discussions.
They put in some stuff that I think are really good, and then some stuff that'll probably be a little challenging for the Senate to willing to then move with that.
The good things in the House version, according to Watney.
We've got some enhancement to the reference prices and the ARC payment levels. That's something we've been asking for because we've been, you know, relatively flat. And of course, just like everybody else, inflation is driving our costs up. There's a little bit of adjustment to some subsidy rates on crop insurance, which may enable farmers to buy up a little bit so that they can have better coverage or more coverage if they need it.
But he says there are some negatives. He says it appears the bill would make cuts in the SNAP program or food stamps, which could make the bill unpalatable with more urban members of Congress.
We don't support cutting SNAP. We're about feeding people. We're in a, you know, kind of a tough economic time from inflation that causes us to have a need for people to be well fed. And I think that's a good thing. And then it will create this political argument on the farm bill that may delay the ability for them to pass one.
Watney says he's looking forward to see the Senate version of the farm bill. And the North Dakota Game and Fish Department is sending a simple message to the well-intentioned who want to rescue what appear to be orphaned baby animals this time of year. Don't touch them. Conservation biologist Patrick Isaacson says most times when you see a young animal alone, its mother is nearby waiting for you to leave.
I do get a number of calls each year, you know, people asking what to do with animals that they find. And on occasion, people do pick them up and ask us what to do with them after that, and we'll have to come get them. Or most of the time, we ask people to just put them back where they found them. But I would say we've been talking about this for years, and I think it's doing a good job of getting the information out there.
Isaacson says anytime a young wild animal has human contact, its chances of survival decrease significantly. It's illegal to take wild animals home, and captive animals later returned to the wild will struggle to survive without learning survival skills from its mother. He says there are two main reasons why they ask people not to interact with baby animals.
One, you know, people pick animals up because they think they've been abandoned. But if you take them from the spot that they've been left by the adults, they may very well be abandoned at that point. And the second reason would be the potential to introduce diseases from humans to animals, or potentially diseases from animals to humans, right? So we try to just have people avoid that interaction, you know, handling an animal.
I'm Danielle Webster.
And we're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg, joined now by travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson. We have her on once a month to talk about travel. And Alicia, it is a long holiday weekend, of course, a time when many people get together to bring flowers to graves of their loved ones, especially if that loved one was lost in a war. And it is a time where we try to get together and spend a little bit more family time. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this idea that, yeah, when we think travel, it's easy to think, oh, yay, I'm going on vacation. But there is this other element of it. Sometimes we travel to remember that we're a part of a community and to honor those who have been lost to us.
Absolutely. And that's a really important, that connection with culture and place and family and people that we love. It's a big reason why we travel. And it always sort of bothers me when people think, oh, I don't travel anywhere. And then they tell me, you know, I say, what are you doing for the long holiday weekend? And they say, oh, I'm going to my cousin's house. We do a family barbecue every year. Or we always go up to the cemetery and tend the graves and put out the flags, that kind of a thing. People tell me we don't travel, we don't get together much. But then they go ahead and tell me that they're doing exactly that. And I think sometimes we just go a little numb to
I'm a little guilty of that.
Yeah.
That it has to be kind of a go big or go home to qualify as a trip.
Well, we think it has to be some big bucket list thing. But what I always encourage people to do, and this is a great time to do it because we're coming up Memorial Day weekend is kind of the unofficial start of summer for most people I know. Schools are wrapping up if they're not finished. Those obligations with graduations are ending. You can kind of look and think what kind of experiences you want to have this summer. And I always encourage people to do this, not a bucket list per se. It's not about ticking things off a list. It's about really digging into what you want to feel and thinking about those summertime pleasures. I mean, we have four seasons here, but it always feels like summer is the shortest one. And there's so many opportunities to get out and enjoy ourselves. So think about those summer things that you can do maybe on the way, you know, to the cemetery where you're going to honor loved ones, or on the way to that family barbecue, or on the way to open up the lake house for the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, think about state parks. Think about the kind of things you want to do when you're out and about. So,
you know, I think about a friend of mine who lost her mother, and one of the things that she does is plants her mother's favorite flowers.
Oh, that's gorgeous. And there's so many ways that we can, for a lot of people, you know, being outside, enjoying nature, gardening is such a huge part of what makes a summer summer. Mm. And I think I've seen so many people, even in apartments, that are creating these beautiful little trellised gardens for themselves. And you can do that. You can, you know, use meaningful plants. You can, you know, transplant some cuttings from gardens of loved ones and move those around. You can be out and about. If somebody loved being outside, you can go take a hike in their honor. You can go experience some gardens. You can go walk in the neighborhood. You can go, if they love the lake, spend some time and think about that person when you get out on the kayak on the water for the first time this season. Yeah. There's so many little things that we can do, and they make our lives richer, and they keep those loved ones' memories alive.
Yeah, and then you were also talking, too, about thinking about this sort of experience list, and so much of both of those is this idea that it's kind of a state of being, and it's a feeling that you're trying to create when you're doing this. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely, and I would encourage people to be really intentional. For instance, I really love outdoor festivals. There's something about being, you know, you're cooped up all winter, then you're able to be out window shopping and maybe having some ice cream or a nice cold drink. So kind of look ahead, look at what's on the calendar, even as soon as this weekend. If you're on the move, Skyfest over Fort Stevenson in Garrison, they have these kites and people come from all over the world. And it's just
fascinating. They're incredible, actually.
It's hypnotic. We happened to stop in. We didn't know what was happening a few Memorial Day weekends several years ago. And we just, every time we stopped in, it was different.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. It was vibrant. And the, you know, the kites flying over the water, it was just fascinating. And I think, you know, sometimes you stumble upon these things, and sometimes you have to be a little intentional about it. So I always mark my calendar. The Shady Hollow Flea Market near Detroit Lakes is opening this weekend, too. So I like to go out to that. I brought my parents and my niece and nephew and my son last year and just kind of explored and looked around and shopped. And some of those things are only for one weekend, and some, like flea markets, go on every weekend. So if you're busy this weekend, that's fine. If that's the kind of experience you want to have, if you enjoy garage selling in your neighborhood, you're really going to like a flea market, right?
Right?
So it's just kind of about elevating those fun experiences that you like. So if you enjoy a treasure hunt on a small scale, you're going to enjoy it on a larger scale. If you love Red Hawks baseball, maybe here in Fargo, maybe it's time to do a little traveling. I mean, you can go to Winnipeg and watch them play, go to St. Paul and catch a Saints game, or, you know, the Bismarck Larks open their season on Memorial Day. And I have to tell you, the Northwoods League, they have the absolute best names, by the way. So, like, if you're a Larks fan, you need to hang out and, like, you can check the Badlands Big Sticks. They're new. They're also here in North Dakota.
I didn't know about the Badland Big Sticks, but what a great name to honor Theodore Roosevelt, too.
And they play the Rochester Honkers. And the Minnesota Mud Puppies, which is great.
I want to go just for how cute this is.
I know, right? And I want all the t-shirts. And then you go to Minot because they're the Hot Tots, which is the best ever.
The Minot Hot Tots.
I know.
Who came up with that?
I don't know.
Call me. Send me an email, mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. I want to talk to you.
And I need all the merch. I'm a huge supporter. Like, they've got me with the name. So, like, and that's fun, too, because those kind of those minor league games, they're not necessarily aimed at, you know, hardcore baseball fans that are sitting there with their stat sheets and keeping score. It's about being out in the sunshine and having a hot dog and ice cream and hanging out with friends and family and watching the action on the sidelines, too. They have fun games and stuff.
Yeah.
So it just keeps it interesting.
Well, and Alicia, look at the thing we just did. We didn't actually even go anywhere yet, and we're already having so much more fun about summer just in this ideation phase.
Exactly. Just thinking and dreaming is super fun. And I always tell people, you don't have to go far. If you want to, you know, have a picnic or eat on a patio, and you maybe don't have a balcony or a patio at your house, no big deal. There's really cool patios all over the state. I really like Luft in Bismarck. You can go to Rhombus in Fargo. Sky Prairie at the Hodo here in Fargo is open. And it just feels a little special, and a little elevated, in some cases literally elevated because you're on a rooftop in many of these instances.
Right.
But like you spend a few dollars on a cocktail or you split an appetizer or something, and it's not an unusual experience, and you're maybe not going very far from home, but it feels like summer because you're watching that sunset and you can hear traffic and you're out with friends, and it just feels a little bit different.
There is something special about just being able to do all of these normal things, but outside.
Yes, and I think Midwesterners, we do not take that for granted. And the most common complaint that I get is people look up and they say, I feel like it was just Memorial Day and now it's the 4th of July and summer's half over. So you really do have to be intentional about it.
Yeah.
I am old school. I will take out like physical calendars and write things down. And you will see.
Okay.
Nobody gets to complain to me there's nothing to do in North Dakota and Western Minnesota, because there will be a list on some days where it's like 12 deep of things that I'm interested in within an hour's drive of my home. And that's the case everywhere. I do calendars for the whole state of North Dakota. There is always something, you just have to look. So ask around, talk to your friends, and really be intentional about those experiences that you want, whether it's getting out and spending time by the pool, whether it's taking that state park trip, whether it's going to experience a new lake, or even just hopping in the car and taking a little bit of a spontaneous road trip. Yeah, it's busy this weekend. Yes, you'll probably have to call ahead and reserve, but you'll find something.
So many great ideas from a travel writer, Alicia Underlie-Nelson. You can get even more of her ideas at her website, prairiestylefile.com. Alicia, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
All right, you know, I've heard of hazard pay. There needs to be some kind of pay recording a food segment when you're hungry. We're back on Main Street. That laugh joining me in studio is Rick Guillon, kind of our food go-to guy here for Prairie Plates. Rick, a lot of food stuff, as always, going on. I want to talk about a world record attempt slash success over this past weekend.
Yeah, I'd call it a big success because they had 1,150 participants at Fort Stevenson State Park, which is near Garrison, North Dakota. And it was a Guinness World Record set for the most s'mores consumed at the same time. You had to.
I love it so much.
You had to roast the marshmallows at the same time and eat them at the same time.
Yeah, listen, I could have done that by myself. We did fancy s'mores for when Zach and I got married. It was ginger molasses cookies, sea salt caramel chocolate, toasted coconut marshmallows or vanilla marshmallows or plain. And then, do you want to know a secret?
Sure.
Jam.
Wow, what kind? Like raspberry?
Blueberry jam. Blueberry jam from IKEA. It's amazing. Honest more. Why? You'll never go back.
And why wasn't I invited to this wedding?
Did I know you 13 years ago? No. Anyway, tell us a little bit more about why they even attempted this, besides the obvious. I mean, everybody wants s'mores.
I think North Dakota just is trying to get on the map with some sort of world's largest this or world's largest that again. And, you know, the snow angel competition at the state.
We have so much space.
We do, and we're very creative.
We can put big things there.
We're very creative. We have to come up with things to stay busy. But anyway, this has been tried before at the same location, and 891, I guess. But they really smashed this record. And so I just think it was kind of a thing. It's getting to be outdoor season. People want to get out and do some stuff. And I like to get out and eat. So that's a good.
And then these kinds of things have rules, right? Like they had to roast the marshmallows for 20 seconds and then eat them all at the same time. What?
Well, do you get thrown out for not?
Rules for the sake of rules is always funny to me, but.
Yeah, do they boot you out or is the record like null and void or what? They really.
So many questions. We're going to have to call these Guinness people. What is happening here?
That would be a good interview.
All right. Now, there was also a big burger slam. Presumably not quite the same amount of rules when it comes to consuming the burgers. A little bit more open. And lots of artistic flair here for Bismarck's inaugural Burger Slam.
Yeah, 8 competitors, downtown Bismarck. JL Beers won with their fiery street corn burger. I was just in Bismarck and really wanted to try this, but we had a donor dinner, so I was full. But next time.
You don't have a second burger stomach, Rick? Amateur.
I'm not a cow, Ashley.
I've had street corn, and obviously I've had burgers. I've never had street corn on a burger.
Well, maybe we should request the Fargo jail beers, and then we'll just go over there after we're done with this segment.
This is what we're going to do with any power that comes from this segment, is try to get people to give us food.
It's inspirational. And
okay, but for real, what goes into a Burger Slam?
Well, there are usually quite a few competitors. This one was 8. There's an upcoming downtown Fargo Burger Royale coming up. They have 18 competitors. I'm guessing it'll be 20, over 20 at some point. That's coming up in June. And then it's not like you have to sit there and eat it in some sort of timed competition or that sort of
it's
thing.
It's not an eating competition.
Right. So you go in and you eat the burger that's featured and then judge it with an app. And in this case, there were 5 categories. Bun, toppings, burger, obviously, etc. And so that's kind of how you do it. And the one in Fargo is very similar. So,
do you know, does it have to be a meat burger? I mean, there's lots of good mushroom burgers, quinoa burgers, what have you.
I missed the wild rice burger at the Hodo, but yes, you are correct. And I think you're going to see some evolving things with this. On my Fargo Moorhead Eats Facebook group, there were a few people that chimed in, what about a veggie burger or something? And I think that's really a good point because not everyone eats meat, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, veggie burgers, vegan burgers can be quite good. So yes, I think you'll be seeing that in the future. But this is kind of the inaugural run for Bismarck, second year for Fargo. So it'll evolve, I think. But yeah, it's really a neat event, and I'm glad they're doing it.
All right, and I hear there was a competition statewide here for the best burger in North Dakota, and you handed me a list here of the top 4. So do we narrow it down from 4, or is it just the best few burgers in the state?
Well, yeah, this is a competition that caught my eye by the North Dakota Beef Commission. I caught it on Facebook, and they're doing like a People's Choice vote for your best like burger establishment in the state of North Dakota. And the top 4, and the nominations are done. So now these top 4 move on. The Finish Line Burgers and Brew in Velva.
Okay, that's a little south of Minot.
Red Light Bar in Max.
Between Bismarck and Minot, okay.
That's one of my favorite North Dakota town names, Max and Max Bass. I've been to both, too, a couple times.
I love that.
The Old 281 Tavern in Minnewaukan.
Okay, not too far out of Devil's Lake.
And then closer to Fargo here, and this gets a lot of attention on my food in my food group, the Uptown Eatery in Kindred, and they also do a lot of barbecues.
Southeast corner.
Yeah.
Okay, let's just point out the obvious here, the top 4 burgers in the state that will go on to compete for best. We don't have Fargo on here. We don't have Grand Forks. We don't have Bismarck. We don't have Minot. We don't have Williston. These are all small towns.
Yeah, it's kind of unique.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for just a hot second about small town cooking still then. And, you know, what it is we love about the small town cafe.
I love small town cafes. I'm in southwestern North Dakota quite a bit, so I do go to some of the cafes down there. And the Pheasant in Mott is a favorite spot of mine. I just think there's some camaraderie. It's always home-cooked food. People love it. It's just one of those things that is very North Dakota. And be legendary. Go to small-town cafes. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where you need to just explore rural North Dakota.
So people can go to ndbeef.org and, well, first you got to go taste all these burgers, but then go on and vote on this website. So sounds like they're trying to say get out across the state, too, which is something kind of handy to do on a long holiday weekend.
I'm guessing there were a lot of patrons that voted for these places. Just guessing.
Well, we want to mention a quick food event happening again this long weekend. The Plains Art Museum in Fargo on Friday has an Asian night market. What is that?
Yeah, and it goes from 4:30 to 9 Friday night at the Plains Art Museum. There'll be a lot of vendors, crafts, that sort of thing, but a lot of food. And K-Dog, Korean corn dogs, knit spring rolls, those are very good. Saigon cuisine, to name a few, Namaste Kitchen, just a lot of good food. And just go and hang out and check out other cultures. I like ethnic food. That's one of my big things, so I will be there for a little while.
All right, and then now to talk about Memorial Day. This is a time, of course, that we pay thanks to fallen soldiers, and a lot of times that results in people getting together and celebrating what they worked so hard for. What are some of your recommendations for Memorial Day, Rick?
Well, for me, I like family cooking or cooking with friends, that sort of thing, and I'm big into grilling with charcoal. As you know, we did a grilling segment.
We did a whole segment on it.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. And I like, you know, steaks, ribeye steaks are kind of my favorite. Burgers, brats, veggie burgers. You can do vegan and veggie sausages if you want. I really like vegetables on the grill. We talked about that a little bit a few weeks ago. That's really good. But I do like salads and cut fruit. I love cut watermelon, stuff like that, if it's really cold, that sort of thing. And homemade bars, that would...
You got to have some bars.
Yes, that tops it all off. And then if you have some, you know, adult beverages, some cold beverages,
some
that can
coffee?
Make...
What?
Yeah, well, coffee's good, too, but maybe with a little something in it, too. But
well, you know, that's definitely a thing. Yeah, I love this, people getting together. Something I'm noticing, Rick, increasingly popular Facebook page that you're running here. Remind our listeners what the Facebook page is and then other ways to interact with you, with us here. There's email, there's Facebook.
Yeah, you can find me at plates@prairiepublic.org here or go to Fargo-Moorhead Eats. It's a Facebook group. There's also a page, but go to the group. The group's almost 40,000 people. I do accept posts kind of within an hour radius of Fargo, but there are a lot of people on there from all over the state of North Dakota looking for good food. So, yeah.
Is that getting to be a bit much to monitor? 40,000 people? I mean, I know most of those people are probably just looking, maybe occasionally sharing. I imagine at some point you get people who are, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? And then, you know, it's the internet. Some people will complain.
Well, of course they are. Well, you know, it's just that's how it goes.
It's people.
And it's interesting how food can get political or can get argumentative. And I don't know. I just try not to go there. We keep it positive. I'm thankful I have a co-admin that helps during the day. I'm not gonna admit to it being too much work because my boss is here, Mike. Oh, why did we hire this guy?
You do have a job. Well, your job is to connect people, so, you know, doubling down on food's kind of a thing.
Well, and everyone likes to eat, and that's the thing. It does bring people together, although some people like to argue. But 99% of the time, yes, it is what brings cultures together, what brings people together, what brings political people together. And I just think it's just an all-around good thing to do.
All right. Well, again, plates@prairiepublic.org, or one more time with the Facebook group.
Fargo Moorhead Eats on Facebook.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 22nd.
On this date, in 1917, the North Dakota Attorney General's office made a shocking announcement. An arrest warrant had been issued for the president of the Soo Line Railroad, Edmund Pennington, for bringing liquor into the state. The assistant attorney general said immense quantities of liquor had been shipped to illegal clubs, blind pigs, and bawdy houses. North Dakota had been a dry state since statehood. In 1917, House Bill 39, also known as the Bone Dry Law, had made importing alcohol illegal, even to pharmacies for medical purposes. A raid on a Soo Line train in Minot had found a shipment of alcohol. The assistant attorney general announced that he would request that Governor Frazier seek to extradite Pennington from Minnesota if he did not appear in Minot. Every sheriff in North Dakota was notified to arrest Pennington if he entered the state. Pennington traveled to Minot that July to answer to the charges. He paid a $1,000 bond in advance of his bootlegging trial. According to the Ward County Independent, he has the distinction of being the wealthiest man in the world facing such a charge. Pennington did not seem to let the impending case interfere with his professional or personal life. He continued to appear in newspaper articles in North Dakota and Minnesota discussing railroad business, attending charity events, and giving guest lectures. On May 20th the following year, the charges against Pennington were dropped. Instead, charges were leveled against the Soo Line as a corporation. That same day, Pennington was re-elected president of the Soo Line by the board of directors. The bootlegging charge was no more than a tiny bump in the road of Edmund Pennington's life. His railroad career spanned 53 years. He was president of the Soo Line from 1909 to 1922, then became chairman of the Soo Line board. He also served as president of the Western Express and First National Bank. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Chef Fadi Katan started writing a cookbook that celebrates Palestinian food long before the war in Gaza. And at first, he couldn't cook when the war broke out as people starved. But then he said he realized Palestinian cuisine must be preserved.
I try and channel it into what I'm cooking. I try channeling it into a positive.
The Culinary Lives of Palestinians on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. Tomorrow on the show, Matt Olien reviews the Netflix movie, The Idea of You, starring Anne Hathaway, and Dave Thompson, our news director, catches up on this week's news. Until tomorrow, we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.